Good day, and welcome to the Social Security Administration National Disability Forum conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Doug Walker. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and let me just confirm that our folks on the phone can hear me. As if someone on the phone would just respond so we can hear you, can you confirm that you can hear me?
Yes, you are heard loud and clear.
Okay, terrific. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the National Disability Forum. Thank you so much for coming. We have a lot to talk about, and judging by the registrations, a lot of folks to talk about it, it would seem. This is not the size of a Bernie Sanders rally. However, we didn't pay anybody to be here. That was just a little contemporary humor and not intended to be for the advancement or detriment of any political candidate. Just want to cover myself. I had a hashtag lecture yesterday, so I just want to be on point. So we come to the forum today, united individuals in a common purpose to improve the lives of people with disabilities. As the Deputy Commissioner for Communications at the Social Security Administration, I have the privilege of reaching out to organizations and individuals around the country who care deeply about the work that we do and the work that we all do for the people we serve. By listening to voices like yours, we help to ensure that we are doing the best job we can on a daily basis, and we thank you for your candid feedback. Those in this room and those joining us by phone are some of the most dedicated champions for people with disabilities. You are doing the Lord's work, as they say. People who in many cases depend on these organizations are represented here to stand up for their interests, and this includes working with government agencies like Social Security to be sure that our programs, policies, and services are fulfilling their intended purpose as efficiently and effectively as possible. We commence this discussion at a time when members of Congress are seeking input on how to market opportunities for people with disabilities who want to go to work. Your suggestions will not only help us, they'll inform members of Congress as they work toward gathering and reviewing ideas for the disability program. I'm looking forward to hearing from you today, we all are, and throughout this important process. At the end of the event, we will ask you to complete our survey and continue this policy dialogue by participating with our idea scale tool, and I actually would like to have your candid feedback on the tool itself. We will send out links to you following the meeting today. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Virginia Reno. She's participated in our last disability forum in her capacity as Vice President for Income Security and at the National Academy for Social Insurance. It is my privilege to introduce her today as the Deputy Commissioner for Retirement and Disability Policy. I am happy to call her colleague and friend, Virginia Reno.
Well, thank you very much, Doug. The warm compliments are I would like to reciprocate. It's a pleasure working with Doug in his capacity as leading our communications efforts. And good afternoon, everyone. I am delighted to see you here. It's great to see many familiar faces and also some people that we don't know, and we look forward to hearing from each of you. As Doug said, I was on the other side of the table at the last disability forum, and I'm delighted to be here as part of the Social Security Administration and also bring you greetings from Commissioner Colvin, who is not able to be with us today but cares very deeply about the childhood disability program of the SSI program. So thank you for being here. Our forum today focuses on children who receive supplemental security income because they have disabilities. The goal is to explore challenges they face in making the transition to successful adulthood. We will be sharing findings from SSO and research and evaluation projects, and we also hope to learn from our colleagues from other federal agencies who are in the business of providing services to children and young adults, as well as, in some cases, adults, but children with special health care needs or children and adults with disabilities and who need support in finding successful transition to the workforce. Today, about 1.3 million children receive supplemental security income benefits. Like all children, they need nurture, care, and stability in their lives in order to thrive. But SFI children also face extra disadvantages and challenges. They have significant disabilities, otherwise they wouldn't be receiving the benefits, and they live in families with very low incomes. About one in three children receiving SSI benefits have incomes below the poverty, despite the fact that their families receive some help from SSI. Nearly 20 years ago, I was involved at the National Academy of Social Insurance in a major disability evaluation project. We looked at the overall Social Security disability programs, and we also took a special look at the SSI Childhood Disability Program. And we did that at a time when that program was under attack. It was being, the purpose and rationale for that program was being seriously challenged in the media and among some policymakers. And as part of its report, our panel on SSI childhood disability contributed by coming forth with a clear rationale for that program, a rationale that is rooted in the legislative history of the program, but it was amplified by that panel. That is, they said there's a clear rationale and a compelling need for cash support for families who have a child with a disability. The purpose of these benefits is to support and preserve the capacity of families to care for their children in their own homes. The benefits can help in at least three important ways, and the panel identified these three. To meet some of the additional disability-related costs of raising a child with special needs. To compensate for some of the income loss because of the everyday necessities of caring for a child with a disability or special health care needs, including, in many cases, the loss of parents' capacity to work full-time because of the demands of caring for their child. And finally, obviously, because these are low-income families to begin with, to meet the child's basic needs of food, clothing, and shelter. Without such supports, the children would be at much greater risk of losing both a secure home environment and the best opportunity for integration into community life, including the world of work as adults. So that is kind of the grounding I felt when I came to this program, and I'm thrilled that we are continuing that discussion today. I'd like to turn it over to David Weaver, who is our Associate Commissioner for the Office of Research, Demonstrations, and Employment Support. He will explain the format for today. He will introduce our speakers and lead the discussion. So thank you so much for being here. We do look forward very much to hearing from the people who are here today, as well as people who are listening in by telephone to contribute to our discussion, because we're looking for new and creative ways to help bring together the resources families need to help their children thrive as adults. Thank you, David.
Okay. Thank you, Virginia. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm David Weaver. I head up, as Virginia said, the Office of Research, Demonstration, and Employment Support at Social Security Administration. The Disability Forum series is really the brainchild of Gina Clemens, who's a colleague of mine in Social Security's Office of Disability Policy. So I do want to first thank her for making the forum series available to us today to discuss the youth transition issues. As many of you may know, my shop at Social Security has a strong focus on disability and return to work, and that includes programs that serve adult beneficiaries, such as the Ticket to Work program. But what may not be as well known is that youth have always been a special focus of my shop and really all of the components at the Social Security Administration. So when we talk about youth, there is a focus, as Virginia alluded to, on eventual employment or successful labor market outcomes. But we're also interested in other outcomes, including educational attainment, good health, overall income security, and well-being. We've put together a terrific panel today that can help foster sort of a broad discussion of the issues affecting youth transitioning to adulthood. First, we will hear from Molly Costanzo, the Social Security Administration. Molly's going to help frame the issues for the discussion by walking us through data, research, and policy on youth and the Supplemental Security Income Program. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Marie Mann of the Health Resources and Services Administration. Marie will bring, I think, a new and interesting perspective to these discussions as she brings on health programs and health transitions facing youth. We'll then hear from Janet Labreck, who is the Commissioner of Rehabilitation Services, talk a little bit about the role of vocational rehabilitation and some of the emerging priorities focused on youth. And finally, batting cleanup, T.J. Sutcliffe, who is the Director of Income and Housing Policy at the ARC. I think her remarks and presentation will give us a perspective that isn't just the federal perspective, but really the perspective from families and youth who receive our benefits. How do they rely on those benefits? How do they perceive the federal programs? What services do they really rely on? I believe the bios of all our distinguished presenters are in your packet for more information. Before I turn it over to Molly to kick us off, just a note about some of the mechanics or logistics. After the panel presentations, we will have a panel discussion, and then we're going to open it up to everyone in attendance today for questions, comments, and ideas. Now, we can take questions via microphone for folks who are with us today or by phone, but I'm also told, and they've got the low-tech person working this, but I'm told, that's me, we can also get questions by email, and then they'll be printed out, and I'll read them, and we can get responses. But let me give you the email address for folks who are want to send their questions in by email. It's National Disability Forum, all one word, at ssa.gov. So that's National Disability Forum at ssa.gov. Okay. So, again, the structure will be we'll have a panel discussion, then we're going to open it up for a general discussion with everybody in attendance. Our goal today is to get your feedback in two areas, practice and policy. So let me say that again, practice and policy. By practice, I mean there may be things the federal government or other organizations can do right now or in the near term to improve the lives of young people. We want to hear your ideas. Social Security Administration and other federal agencies and other organizations have a great touch and contact with this population. We're routinely sending them notices. We have a terrific house of communication. We have ability to perhaps do practical things immediately, and we're interested in your ideas. By policy, I mean longer-term solutions that could involve legislation or other policy vehicles. So as we go through the presentations, always be keeping in mind, what do you want to raise in terms of both practice and policy? Today you can offer us your feedback, but later in the session I'll highlight the idea scale mechanism that Doug mentioned at the beginning. I'll talk a little bit about some of the questions we've posed on idea scale and what we're looking for in responses. But with that, let me stand out of the way a little bit and let see if Molly can get us started today.
Thanks, David. As everyone has said already, it's exciting to be here today to be able to hear from all of you and kind of have a discussion about important issues. Sorry, I'm not projecting and the microphone is also not helping. Hopefully this is better. Okay, great. As David mentioned, my presentation is just sort of going to frame the discussion, talk a little bit about what we know about SSI youth and their families and some of their transition experiences. I also want to mention that though I am here presenting to you today, there's lots of other folks at SSA who are spending a lot of time thinking about these issues as well. I want to specifically mention Joy Cobb, who's in the audience today, and Jeff Heminer, who is not. Those are my colleagues in ORDES, and they helped contribute to getting this presentation ready for you today. The last thing I want to mention before I start is sort of a preemptive apology. I have a 2-month-old at home, and so my hours of consecutive sleep are at an all-time low. So if I say something that doesn't sound quite right, that's probably why. Okay, the first slide is just probably some items we're all familiar with, going over how a child is eligible to receive SSI. The first point, as was pointed out earlier, it's a means-tested program, so there's an assets and an earnings limit. Parental income and parental assets are deemed to children, and you can see here that the limits are not exceedingly generous. The second point point is that they have to meet SSA's definition of disability, which is a medically determinable physical or mental impairment that results in, and this is bolded, so it must be important, marked and severe functional limitations and can be expected to result in death or has lasted or can be expected to last for a continuous period of not less than 12 months. And the reason, in later we'll see the adult definition of disability, and spoiler alert, it's not the same. So that's why that's bolded. The slide also kind of goes over a few of the historical changes in how children were found eligible for SSI, and I think we could have a very long presentation and discussion about that. So that's kind of all I'm going to say about it today. Right, the next slide. And this slide is just a graphical depiction of kind of the historical trends of SSI child participation. And you can see in the graph those sort of two bend points with the Zebley decision and welfare reform and the impacts that that has had. The other thing I want to point out on this slide is the yellow line. It represents cases where the diagnosis in our records is a mental disorder. And I think we sometimes hear a lot in the media and other discussions about the great increase in mental disorders in children that the Children's SSI program. And you can see here that it's actually really sort of the share has kind of remained the same historically, and it's always been a big part of the program. The last thing I kind of want to mention on that slide is just that you see an increase of the number of cases, but our allowance rate has really remained pretty relatively flat over the last decade or so. So that kind of gave you an idea of numbers. This slide kind of gives you an idea of the variety of health issues that children are facing, children on SSI. So SSA has, I want to say it's 23 different, like, diagnostic groups for statistical purposes, although I might be wrong about that. And I just have the top five here, as well as the share for all children and for children in that transition age. And they're actually the same top five for all children and for transition age youth, but the kind of the ranking or the order differs a little bit. And so I think when we're talking about what sort of interventions we might want to put in place or supports that might be helpful to this population, I think it's important to keep in mind this kind of wide variety of health issues that we see, right? So when we think of support that someone with a developmental disorder or let's say a speech and language delay, for example, might need, it probably looks a lot different or at least a little different than maybe what someone with a diagnosis of epilepsy would need. So sort of just, again, that point that it's a very diverse population with a lot of different issues. I also want to point out here that sort of the largest two diagnostic groups, they're the same for all children and for transition age children, but they're reversed in terms of the first and second. But for example, developmental disorders, that includes things like speech and language delays, and those don't always have an analog when we move from a childhood listing to an adult listing. Certainly they could sort of develop into something that might be an adult listing, but it might not be a one-for-one comparison. And the same thing, obviously, with the childhood and adolescent disorders. So something to keep in mind when we think about that transition. Finally, ready for the next slide? So another kind of, I think, way or something that we want to keep in mind when we're discussing policies and practices is the context of family. I think families and households are really important to understanding supports that might be needed. And so in this slide, and this I think we've already sort of gone over, but the SSI children come from very low-income families. As Virginia mentioned, about a third of them live below the federal poverty level with their benefits. And the federal poverty level is not extremely high. And the without benefits, it would be even higher. It would be 57.5%. Families are generally connected to sort of the broader social safety net or social safety patchwork, if you will. They have a lot of, about 65% are receiving SNAP benefits. I have energy assistance on the slide that also would include housing assistance and a variety of other sort of programs and safety net supports. And Medicaid, obviously a large majority of SSI children do receive Medicaid. So we're here today to talk about transition, and in SSA world, the age 18 redetermination is the big transition event. So what is the age 18 redetermination? It's a new medical decision, so all children who receive SSI have to receive a new medical decision once they turn 18. And this is something that I sort of alluded to or danced around earlier, but the important parts about this is that there are listing differences between childhood listings and adult listings, right? So the condition that someone may have been allowed under as a child may not be an adult listing or... and then the second thing that I also sort of started to talk about earlier is that the adult definition of disability under SSA rules is different from that of a child. You can see here that the bolded portion reads the inability to do any substantial gainful activity, so it's different than that marked and severe criteria that we have for children. We know that about two-thirds of children continue to receive SSI as adults. What happens to that additional one-third that do not? Their payment may not, it's possible that it might not cease immediately because they can appeal, and also there's the Section 301 provision that allows payments to continue for participation in individualized education program or VR or other similar services, so payments then would continue until they've completed that program. Even those that do stop receiving SSI at age 18, within 10 years, we know that about 14% of them do return to the program, so they reapply and are allowed under the adult criteria again. So kind of when we think about how can we help make this transition more successful, transition to education and employment more successful, we want to think about what barriers might be preventing that. And I am a social worker by training, so I think it's helpful to think about it as the personal and family context as well as the environmental context. And I don't want to go over all of these barriers here today, but for example, you know, expectations about work, on the ability to work, that goes into motivation and kind of self-confidence, fear of benefit loss. We saw sort of with those statistics how important that check is to family income, so you can understand why families might be fearful of losing that benefit, and that's sort of why benefit counseling might be a very important piece of any sort of transition that we talk about. Additionally, kind of limited work experience and limited work-ready skills. I think a lot of 16-year-olds, you would say, would have limited work experience, so that's maybe not unique to this population. And when we talk about work-ready skills, I think these youth have the work skills where to do entry-level jobs with no problems. I think issue might be sort of the soft skills that come with getting a job, so sort of filling out an application, how to do an interview if necessary, and kind of those issues. In the environmental context, inadequate services and supports, kind of fragmented system, so between at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level, kind of how all of those services may or may not overlap, program disincentives and societal perception. I said I wasn't going to go over all of them, but it turns out that I did. Sorry about that. Next slide. So what is happening with these youth before the age 18 redetermination? So education-wise, we know that about 75% of them receive some sort of special education services. What that means could kind of vary from place to place, and sort of the intensity as well. So that's important to keep in mind. About a third of them have had discipline issues at school, so 32% have had an expulsion or a suspension. On the employment and training side, 11% earned over $2,000 annually at age 17. 21% received some vocational training, and some youth also received VR services. So that's what we know about before transition. What do we know about after transition, transition outcomes? Those youth who are no longer receiving SSI at the ages of 19 through 24 are more likely to be employed, which is good news, but they're also more likely to have been arrested or dropped out of school. So that's sort of the other end of the spectrum and much less good news. Those who are still receiving SSI at age 19 are less likely to have been employed or arrested by age 17 and more likely to have had some vocational training by age 17, which might be kind of counterintuitive. Earnings in general are fairly low. In recent award cohorts, we see less than half having earnings in sort of that decade after transition ages 19 through 28. And for those who do have earnings, it's about the average is around $10,000 annually, so not extraordinarily high amounts of earnings. So I think it's also important to keep in mind what's currently in place to help these youth with their transition. VR services, and I will wait because I'm sure that Janet Lebrecht will talk more about this. IDEA services, although, again, so not all youth are eligible for IDEA services. It's not necessarily a one-for-one match. We, on the Promise Project, working with our partners at Department of Ed, this has kind of come up a lot. SSA doesn't have an existing data match to kind of be able to match and see which SSI youth are receiving these services and which ones are not. So that's also important to keep in mind. We do have that with VR, so we can sort of track that. In the private sector, there's two service agencies on here, but there's obviously way, way, way more programs doing transition services. So here we just have Project Search and the Marriott Foundation, but again, there are many, many, many other folks out there doing this work. The next slide, I think we've sort of covered all of this, but just sort of the broader safety net that SSI youth might be plugged into to help with transition. The thing I want to point out here is ABLE accounts. Obviously, the ABLE Act has just recently passed, and implementation is just starting in some of the states, so we don't really know what that will look like or how participation will go. But certainly, we hope to be able to follow that and how SSI youth take advantage of that new service and support. I think we can go to the next slide, whenever. But I can talk about this slide too while we're waiting. just those things we already covered. So again, 3/5 of SSI children do receive SNAP benefits. TANF, the important thing to remember about TANF is that the monthly benefit amount for SSI is higher than that of TANF, but the number of cases is much less. Looks like we've moved on, so I can go on. So that's sort of the current environment outside of SSA. And now I'm going to turn to talk a little bit about some of the demonstration projects that SSA has been involved in and is currently involved in with transition age youth. The first is the youth transition demonstration. Sorry, is the back one. Yeah, there it goes. Thank you. And the youth transition demonstration, also known as YTD, it was a random assignment study for youth ages 14 through 25, and it was implemented in 6 community-based sites. YTD also featured 5 program waivers, and those were designed to kind of encourage youth to save and continue their education, kind of, again, with that benefit loss fear that we saw in the barrier slide. YTD, we have the final report from YTD. It's on our website, so everyone can go check it out. But basically, we saw some mixed results after 3 years in the employment outcomes. 4 of the 6 projects had statistically significant positive impacts on paid employment or earnings. And there were no impacts on most of the other outcomes or domains. And I think we saw, and Joy can correct me if I'm going to say anything wrong, but some of the projects we saw the earnings and the employment kind of tail off from the first year of the project, and in others there was actually an increase. Sort of mixed results there. The one major takeaway from YTD that I understand is that we found that sort of the intensity and the quantity of the employment service hours really did have an impact on employment outcomes. So if we want to see better employment outcomes, it's important for any sort of policy or practice intervention to include sort of that intensity of the employment services. So from YTD, we built on YTD, and we're currently working on the PROMISE demonstration. PROMISE is Promoting Readiness of Minors and Supplemental Security Income. The acronym does not entirely line up, so don't spend a lot of time figuring out that E at the end. PROMISE is interagency collaboration at the federal level and at the state level. That design is put in place sort of because of the fragmented services barrier that we saw. So we work really closely with our partners at Department of Ed, DOL, HHS, and OMB on PROMISE. The Department of Education has actually funded these grants, so there's 6 projects, and they're in 11 states. There's basically 5 single state projects and 1 that's a consortium of 6 states. PROMISE is a little bit different from YTD in that it's kind of at the state level. So the idea was to use existing kind of services and support at the state level to kind of have better coordination of these services. PROMISE is also a random assignment design, but again, a little bit different from YTD. It's for youth ages 14 to 16, so sort of at the lower end of that spectrum, since we do know from research that kind of that early intervention for this population does matter. PROMISE also has a focus on the family, and again, so that goes back to the importance of the family context. SSA is responsible for the national evaluation, and we will be our first report, which is actually called the Interim Services and Impact Report, will be out in 2018, so sit tight, and then sit tight longer for the long-term report, which will be in 2022. And I'm sure that some of us at SSA will be following the Youth and PROMISE for many, many years to come. The projects will also be, as part of their grants, they're required to do a formative evaluation, so they will also be putting out some research about what they've learned. So we're hopeful that we will have some evidence of successful interventions from PROMISE, or some evidence of something, how they worked at least. So that's about all that I'm talk about today. So just to sum up, I think it's, again, I want to emphasize that it's a diverse population with a wide variety of service needs, so we don't necessarily want to think about this as kind of a monolith population, one, we need to do one thing and that's it. Again, and I think Virginia mentioned this, I think all transition age youth have a lot of challenges for SSI recipients. They have the added complexity of their health status and income status. And different demonstrations, so YTD and PROMISE, and I know Department of Ed is working on some other demonstration-like projects coming up, and DOL has some as well, may be able to provide us with some evidence of effective services and supports. Thanks. Oh. And then I guess I have the contact information on there and some also references for additional reading if you're interested.
Well, thank you, Molly. That was a great presentation. You got through acronyms, some technical difficulties, covered the gamut. Marie, we're going to, I guess they're not sure they can get the computer back up, but people in the in your folders, you have the PowerPoint presentation, so it's okay with you. We'd like to press on. So next up is Marie Mann from Health Resources and Services Administration. Talk about youth transition issues from the somewhat from the perspective of health and health transition. So, welcome, Marie.
Good afternoon, and I just want to thank the Social Security Administration for this invitation to participate on this panel. I think, as others have said, this is such an important issue, and the more we can work together to address it, I think the better outcomes to be for our youth and their families. So, I'm from the Health Resources and Service Administration. Next slide, please. And within that, the unit that I'm in is the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. In our agency is the Department of Health and Human Services. As you see, the Bureau's mission is to improve the health of all of America's mothers, children, and their families, with the vision of a nation where all mothers, children, and their families are healthy and thriving. Next slide, please. And the Maternal and Child Health Bureau is responsible for administering the MCH Block Grant Program, which is authorized by Title V of the Social Security Act, with the specific purpose of improving the health and well-being of America's mothers, infants, children, and youth, and with specific language, including children and youth with special health care needs and their families. Also, as part of the legislation, in particular, this was with the 1989 Omnibus Budget Act, is to provide and to promote family-centered, community-based coordinated care for children with special health care needs and to facilitate the development of community-based systems of services for such children and their families. Operating as a partnership between federal and state programs, the states have the flexibility to design their own programs, so which accounts for a great deal of variations. And so just to know that one program, if you live in one state, your Title V program there may do things that if when you move to another state, that Title V program may not do, or they may have additional services. So I need to emphasize that in fact there's tremendous variability among the Title V programs. And these programs, in fact, do rely on collaborations at the state level as well as at the federal levels. So among a range of partners, so whether it's healthcare providers, whether it's family, young people, other agencies, to help them achieve their goals and objectives. Next slide. And the funding that the block grant provides allows the states to improve their capacity as well as the quality of the delivery of care. It also allows them to conduct health planning, improve their data capacity, conduct screening, care coordination, training. And examples of some of the initiatives that have that are being carried out are there's medical home initiatives. Some of the states, in fact, support telehealth services, and a number of them, in fact, provide supports to families to serve as advisors within their programs. Also, in certain circumstances, the funding will pay for direct clinical health care services, including providing coverage for children who are uninsured and underinsured. And some of those services may be include genetic screening or nutritional supplement counseling, therapeutic camps, specialty care services. And then also will provide when circumstances occur, the Title V funding will provide rehabilitative services for disabled children and youth under the age of 16 who are receiving SSI benefits but do not qualify for Medicaid. Next slide. I need to emphasize that, in fact, this is the Title V program is not an entitlement program. In fact, it's a public health service program for the MCH population. So it, in fact, is charged with carrying out the core public health functions of assessment, assurance, and policy development, as well as the 10 essential services of public health, including as well as health planning, including education, a myriad of services that support public health functions within the state public health agency. Most recently, the Title V block grant has gone under some reconfiguration, and the focus now is on these six domains: women and women's and maternal health, perinatal and infant health, child health, adolescent health, children with special health care needs, and then life course. Along with in thinking about transforming the block grant, which has taken the last couple of years, there's been additional focus given to how these services are improving outcomes. What is the impact of these services, and how should we measure them? So along with the transformation, 15 national performance measures have been identified, from which the states have to choose 8 based on their own needs assessment and their priorities within their states. And the states have to choose at least one measures from each of the 6 domains. Specifically for children with special health care needs, there are 2 measures. One is medical home. It's the percent of children with and without special health care needs that have a medical home. The other measure is transition. The percent of adolescents aged 12 to 17 with and without special health care needs who receive services necessary to make transitions to adult health care. And in our why we are focusing on that healthcare transition, I think our for those of you who may be familiar with the work of MCHB and Title V, for over 20 years, we have particularly tried to promote a comprehensive system of services for children and youth. And specifically, one of the core outcomes was the transition. But not just we at that, all along we were focusing on how to help these young people transition to independence and full employment and education. But in our work over these last 20 years, we found that increasingly the healthcare transition had emerged as a significant gap. And so over the last several years, we have redirected our efforts and investments on improving healthcare transition with the following goals in mind: to improve the ability of youth and young adults to manage their own health and effectively use health services, and then to ensure organized clinical process to facilitate transition preparation, the transfer of care, and the integration of these young people into adult-centered care in medical home or specialty care settings. To reinforce that point, why healthcare transition? There are estimated 18 million adolescents aged 18 to 21, about one-fourth of whom have chronic conditions, and many more millions, if we count those 20 to 26, who needs to transition from pediatric system of care. And that currently available national data shows that less than 40% of these youth with special health care needs are receiving the needed transition services. Without transition support, the evidence we have identified that health is diminished, the quality of care is compromised, and healthcare costs are increased. The majority of the youth and families are not well prepared for the change, and that youth and young adults often are unable to name their own health condition, they provide the relevant medical history, even know what medication they need to have or be able to obtain their own prescriptions and fill their prescription, and to know what insurance source they have. In addition, many of them don't have a primary care provider or what a setting where they can be a medical home that can coordinate their services, and they often rely on, say, minute clinics or emergency rooms for their health care costs. And so there's a lack of continuity and comprehensiveness of care. And then further, surveys of health care providers consistently show they lack a systematic way to support youth families and young adults in transitioning from pediatric to adult health care. And in this case, we're talking about both pediatric and adult providers. So it should have come up. It's one of those, yeah, thank you. So in going back in 2010, Maternal Child Health Bureau, we sponsor a gathering of representatives from the health profession, both pediatric and adult providers, as well as youth with disabilities and family members of children with special health care needs, to work together to address to develop sort of a plan, or what are the steps we need to undertake to move us forward as far as healthcare transition. And what resulted was a clinical report on transition that was published in 2011 by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the American College of Physicians jointly. The report specifically targets all youth, and beginning with age 12, and provides a structure that allows for branching for youth with special health care needs, and it's easily applicable to both primary and specialty practice. And in going through the processes, it extends through the transfer of care to adult medical home and adult specialists. And just to touch on the age points that we highlighted was that beginning at around age by age 12, roughly, that the youth and family should be aware of beginning that conversation about transition, and that by age 14, the clinician should start begin work with the family to start planning for that healthcare transition. And during this time, there should be preparation of the young person and families for what that would mean, and the discussions of what the youth and the family's preferences for and timing for transferring for adult healthcare. Again, these are guidelines, and it's going variable, depends on the family preferences as well as the ability of the youth and the family to make that transfer. And then by around age 18 to transfer to adult care, unless there are circumstances where that's not possible. But definitely by this time, there should be have had some discussion about guardianship, about privacy of records, as well as allowing the young person to have developed some skills around self-determination. And then sometime between 18 and 22, the actual transfer of care from the pediatric practice to the adult practice. And at this time, there should be accompanying this transfer a self-care skill assessment, a plan of care, updated medical summary, emergency care plan, and if needed, those decision-making documents that will be necessary to assist the adult provider in providing the necessary care. To assist us in moving this forward, the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, funded a national center, which is based at the National Alliance to Advance Adolescent Health. This is a cooperative agreement running from 2014 to 2018, and specifically this center, Gut Transitions, has certain goals that it will be building on to utilize quality improvement methods to help systems to be able to adopt and implement a model of transition, which is called a 6 core elements, and then to spread that work and results from that adoption to other clinical networks and across the country. But similarly, it is also working on transition education training, as well as engaging with the young adult and families to better address their needs, and then to start thinking about what are those policies that needs to be in place to allow us to fully support healthcare transition successfully, and then certainly to disseminate the information that's required. So what I have on this slide is just a diagram of the 6 core elements of transitions. These core elements are discussing transition, having a transition policy in place and discussing it, be able to track the progress through assess the skill of the young person, develop the transition plan, having the transfer documents with the actual transfer, and then having the confirmation that, in fact, transfer occur and completed. The core elements, this model is based on the 2011 clinical report, and it's provides guidance for coordination and communication between the pediatric and adult providers to hopefully improve the preparation of the young person's families as well as the providers in that transition process. Increase the number of youth and young persons with independent healthcare skills, and then improve integration of the young adults as a special population into the adult healthcare system. The model itself has been tested in a number of sites across the country, and the key lessons, what we have learned from these pilots, is that although unprepared to manage their own health and health care, the majority of the young adults who participated indicated that self-care and transition were important to them. And then starting the transition process with young people 18 and older, it's very difficult. It's and it's probably that's why we're emphasizing the need to start earlier, at probably at age 12 to 14, with ongoing health education and self-care skill development. The participant in the transition process score higher on when we were testing for patient activation, goal setting, problem solving, and follow-up. And that the transition care coordination that we, was part of this pilot result in cost savings and as well as improvement in the quality of the chronic illness care. So the just to reiterate, the center is got transition. And the website is www.gottransition, one word, gottransition.org. And certainly lots of resources there, and hopefully you'll be able to visit and utilize those resources. And here's my contact information for those of you who want further information and also would like to talk to me more. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marie. Janet, I know you've been busy thinking about youth issues in VR, so you can walk us through some of the things that are on your plate these days. We'd appreciate it.
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's see, the microphone. Make sure people can hear me. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor to be here this afternoon, and I'd like to thank the Social Security Administration for inviting me here this afternoon to talk about the National Vocational Rehabilitation Program as well. And David, you're absolutely right. This is a very timely discussion for us, and we have been incredibly busy, particularly since the VR program is the program responsible for providing services in a combination of grants, both formula as well as discretionary grants to 80 vocational rehabilitation agencies across the country, as well as the islands and territories, and a range of other programs that we operate. But for the purposes of this presentation today and the discussion that's ongoing today regarding transition age youth, the VR program is also not an entitlement program as well. It is an eligibility-based program that allows individuals with disabilities, and we work in partnership with the Social Security Administration as well around the definition of disability, in supporting individuals with disabilities to achieve their vocational rehabilitation goals and objectives. Ultimately, at the end of their rehabilitation program, the expectation is that we want individuals to be prepared to seek out and earn wages through competitive integrated employment outcomes. And this is critical to where we are today, and as we are presenting today, we recently, as of July 22nd in 2014, the President signed into law in Congress through a bicameral bipartisan act, signed into law the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which is a significant piece of legislation for our particular program as well as our core partners at the Department of Labor, as well as for our partners with HHS, and we're also working with TANF to really identify the issues that really impact individuals with disabilities, particularly looking at those individuals with significant disabilities and helping them to achieve their endeavor for looking at competitive integrated employment. I think also for the purposes of today, this is such a huge topic, and for the VR program, it crosses every program that our individual families and individuals with disabilities who they interface with directly in their families, their community, in a professional settings, and we work with a wide range of other programs and services throughout the disability community that interface with our consumers that are being served by the VR program. And I thought I would focus on three specific areas, cultural, as well as financial, and also I think job readiness factors that play a significant role in assisting individuals with disabilities. And particularly I'm going to focus on those transition age youth and looking at the initiatives and challenges that currently impact those individuals who are transition age youth to really seek out and become job ready for competitive integrated employment. And with this piece of legislation, and I'll call it WIOA from now on because it's such a long title, but specifically under WIOA, we're looking at those youth we're trying to focus on with regard to competitive integrated employment and ensuring that the three factors that I just previously mentioned are no longer barriers for individuals who are, in fact, trying to acquire competitive integrated employment. And when you take the three factors that I mentioned previously, starting with cultural factors, the cultural factors that obviously impact our community that we provide those services to are significant factors, and they range from whatever activities are happening in the family, the perspective of disability within the family, how that disability is perceived in the family, how the individual themselves with a disability perceives themselves as a person with a disability. Do they in fact understand the nature and the scope of their disabilities? How are they in fact limited by their own disability? And what kinds of conversations or expectations, you heard that word earlier today, what kinds of expectations and messaging is going on within their respective families or communities that impact their own perception of what it is that they as individuals with disabilities are able to accomplish or see them, how they see themselves or how it impacts their own individual role within their family or within their culture. The other factor that I mentioned was financial, and for many of the individuals that we serve, we all know that you heard earlier the disparity when you're looking at the poverty level is significant for individuals with disabilities and that you are much more likely to live in poverty or below the poverty line if you are an individual with a disability. You heard earlier as well that many of our families that are being served across federal government as well as local and state governments who are being served by our systems are also in that place where it is extremely challenging for them, not only because of the disability, but because they're already at a disproportionate economic level that really truly is exacerbated when you introduce disability as well. From a personal perspective, I felt that very acutely in my own family. There are 4 out of 6 of us who are blind, all of whom were losing our vision at the same time, the exact same time in childhood. Most of us are 1 or 2 years apart in age, so you can imagine the impact of my family starting to figure out that there was something going on and then simultaneously each one of us being diagnosed with a degenerative progressive eye condition that would eventually lead to total blindness. 4 out of 6 children, the economic implications of that are absolutely overwhelming and incredible. Many of the disability conditions that our individuals that we serve face are lifelong and certainly will have periods where the condition is exacerbated and certainly increases. And when you introduce the topic of children in particular, those barriers are definitely magnified. And so when you're talking about disability, we're also talking about the financial implications of being able to manage that as well, working across the systems to find those supports that are going to be critical for them to navigate their way through childhood into adolescence and into adulthood, and then figuring out how they are going to navigate the systems in conjunction with trying to figure out what their life goals and objectives are. The other financial consideration that is also important around these particular issues is ensuring that individuals with disabilities have the opportunity to, in fact, experience education in a way that is going to benefit them, and that we can't talk about being able to reach competitive integrated employment levels and increase outcomes and without talking about education and the barriers that are impacting individuals who are particularly impacted by disability from childhood, and that we have a special education system, and certainly that the vocational rehabilitation program nationally works in partnership with them to address these types of issues that impact children as they're navigating their way through their educational programs as well. The financial implications also around taking care of these children as they age into adolescence and into adulthood is absolutely staggering. The cost of assistive technology, medical interventions, having health insurance alone that supports the family as well as the individual who is impacted have significant impacts on the family being able to really support their own family objectives while trying to address the financial issues that really continue to present themselves as barriers throughout the life of the person with a disability. If you're looking at some of the issues around having the job readiness skills, the purpose of the vocational rehabilitation program is not only to support the endeavors of the individuals who are being served by our system, but in fact is to really help them to identify strategies and compensatory techniques that they are able to in fact engage in and use so that they can in fact acquire the appropriate skill sets necessary that will make them job ready eventually. Many of the consumers that we serve, and we have approximately 1.1 million people who apply for our services annually, and those individuals who are determined eligible for our services have the opportunity to work one-on-one with an individual counselor in collaboration and in partnership with other agencies that can certainly support their vocational endeavor. We have support services for those individuals who are navigating their way through high school. Those individuals are covered by the school systems. However, the vocational rehabilitation program also partners with them to provide ancillary services and supports around that individual for those particular services that are not covered by the school system. And that is very purposeful because the objective for those individuals is to obviously acquire their education, but also it's the point in time of which and is the primary purpose for WIOA now is to really refocus and take a look at how do we ensure that these individuals are thinking about work. They're thinking about it earlier, that they have the opportunity to acquire the skills earlier, that they understand what it means to become job ready, and that they, in fact, have the opportunity to interface in their community in a way that is inclusive, and that should begin during their school education process as well, and that they have the opportunity to acquire skills in the same way that their peers are acquiring those skills. We know that non-disabled peers oftentimes will have the opportunity to experience early work, and that we know that individuals with disabilities oftentimes do not have that opportunity. And yet we know that if individuals with disabilities do not have that opportunity, that the longer they sit on programs like SSI or SSVI, it doesn't really matter which program it is, that demotivation sets in, that individual's self-perception, their confidence deflates and erodes over time. We also know that it does not help the family situation as well, and that the sooner we can take a proactive strategy for addressing some of these issues, both at the individual as well as at the family level, that we have a better opportunity of connecting individuals who are oftentimes disconnected from services and supports that will ultimately result in them getting reintegrated and being included in many of the community-based programs and services that others have an opportunity to take advantage of. And that's one of the reasons why when you were hearing earlier the information about the PROMISE grants that the Department of Education was happy to engage in that type of research and provide the support necessary for that research to take place so that we could look at a longer-term strategy and determine what happens when the families have that opportunity to engage earlier. How do we begin having those conversations, and how do we ensure that we're connecting these individuals to the appropriate resources earlier so that we can hopefully have an intervention or strategies in place that changes the perception of not only the programs but the opportunities and connect them with resources much earlier on that could potentially lead to success. Many of the individuals that we serve in the vocational rehabilitation program are recipients of either SSI or SSDI, but having been a consumer as well as a vocational rehabilitation counselor and certainly now as a leader in this particular field, I have seen, you know, the opportunities for individuals with disabilities who that when they have those resources, when they are in place, when they are connected, when they have the opportunity to really receive education that is very targeted to what their goals and objectives are, and having the opportunity to acquire work experience early on, I've seen those successes. I still have contact with consumers who have been served by the VR system, and that when they've had those opportunities early on, it does make a significant difference. How we manage and how we connect these individuals as well as other individuals who are served outside of our particular program is critical. The flexibility in terms of both policy as well as practice is absolutely critical to ensuring that individuals as well as their family members have not only the knowledge about the particular services, but how we apply those policies and how we put them in practice really is critical to determining the success factors for individuals. We also, I think, have an opportunity to look today at transition, because transition was not the same meaning as it was when I was an adolescent growing up in the vocational rehabilitation system. And that individuals with disabilities today are much more likely to be integrated into their community. I see transition age youth all the time who are embedded and mainstreamed into their school systems. The system is not perfect, and there is always room for improvement, obviously, but it is much different. Assistive technology and the role that technology plays in general is another area that plays a critical role in ensuring that our transition age youth today, regardless of whom they're being served by, that the training is there, because many of the jobs that these individuals, as well as all of us as adults or as your children coming up through these systems or your children in general in our society, it is very unlikely that you will interface with a job today without having the adequate technology skills to perform the essential duties of any job today. The landscape of our workforce is changing very rapidly. We know that. Our workforce is changing very quickly. Many of our employment arenas around in our country are certainly facing an increase of number of people who are aging out and who are retiring. The skill sets become more complex and require us to be multifaceted in the skills that we do have. And so that it becomes a challenge to really think about how we are preparing transition age youth with disabilities to become, in fact, skilled and job ready, ready to go into the workplace, understanding the decision-making process, the direction that people are being educated in. And is college the single track now? You're hearing a lot more discussion today about career paths, and we're looking in that direction also. Is there more than one direction to a competitive integrated job, and there absolutely is. We as federal leaders have to look at our practices and our policies and the way that they are impacting, and do they really truly present as opportunities, or are there still barriers that are in place that we could certainly examine and have the opportunity to really refocus where the purposeful intent was initially versus where is the need today. We also have the opportunity, I think, to look at the way that the resources both at a federal, state, and local level are being distributed, and looking at the accountability factor. What are we asking of our grantees? What are we expecting from them when we distribute millions and millions of resources to both private, nonprofit organizations or state entities as they receive those grants? What are we asking them to do on behalf of the recipients who all of us serve at some point? And what are the expectations around being able to effectively measure the effectiveness of those grants being distributed and the services being provided to those individuals? And so we at the RSA, the Rehabilitation Services Administration, are in the process of doing that as well and taking a look at all the factors and the processes that we use. And I think that that is not exclusive to us. We're seeing it in other federal agencies as well. And looking at both the performance of the organizations who are our grant recipients, and looking at what our expectations are, and looking at the disability community as a whole, and looking at ways that we can promote and certainly inspire innovation and creativity as we're putting out these grants so that we can, in fact, ensure that we're meeting the needs of the communities that we're all serving, and looking at the effectiveness approach to it as well. WIOA is certainly focused also on our relationships that our specific programs in the vocational rehabilitation arena have with the employer community. How do we best leverage those resources that the employer community has, and how do we best engage them and partner with them so that we can both partner together to encourage them not only to hire individuals but also to teach us about the employment arena today, because the landscape is very different. And how do we best engage them? They are the experts in what they do. We're the experts in disability, but how do we bring those resources and that knowledge together so that we can, in fact, at the end of the line, have a very different outcome for the individuals that we serve? And yet, we also want to be very strategic and impact the need that the employer community has as well. And I think that once we address all of those issues, and I'm hopeful that with this piece of legislation that it, in fact, will begin also to address some of those three factors, the cultural, the financial, as well as the job readiness issues that continue to impact the disability community. And then finally, I would add that the other consideration that we have, which is always an enormous challenge, is transportation. Transportation for the disability community is a significant barrier. It is for all of us when you think about what we have to go through to get to work. Those of you who drive into D.C., you know the challenge trying to drive into D.C. But you know what? You can drive into D.C. You have choices. Individuals with disabilities don't often have those choices. And so when we're talking about strategies for helping individuals to seek out and achieve competitive integrated employment, we have to look at the allocation of our resources as well and look at ways that we can design opportunities for to have those discussions about resources, about transportation, about being able to support the disability community in ways that are going to result in positive outcomes. And you can't have those discussions without thinking about transportation and those types of barriers. All of our consumers cross all of these potential areas. And I think that the thought that I always have is that today, all of us are much more likely to now age into disability than we are to die from a disability. And that's, you know, for multiple reasons. We have technology, medical advances, medications that keep us alive a lot longer. There is information, there's preventative strategies that really support us living longer. Our community-based systems that we have today are not adequate and prepared to deal with that discussion. And I think that until we do, we will continue to face these types of barriers and challenges that will eventually cripple the system if we're not addressing them proactively. And I think that these are some of the challenges and these are some of the issues that impact. I am very hopeful, though, and very excited about some of the partnerships that are coming to fruition with regard to the inception of WIOA, our Social Security partners, all of our partners that you have heard from today, as well as partners who are not here today, are having this discussion around transition. Because today it truly is about youth. So if we're not preparing them today, we are preparing them for a future that will continue to result in being dependent upon all of our systems. So a lot to think about, but also a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunities here. As we really come together to address this issue. So I want to thank you for having me here today and happy to answer questions when we get to that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. It's interesting you mentioned transportation at the end. I can't go to a meeting on disability and work without somebody raising that as the number one issue, so I appreciate you highlighting that. TJ, do you want to walk us through your presentation? And after that, I think I'll mix things up a little bit and go straight to – I'll start the question and answer, but then we'll open up to the audience. So, TJ? Yeah.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. I want to start out by thanking the Social Security Administration for convening today's forum, for the opportunity to be here today, and for all of you who are here in the audience today and on the phones who are here to be part of the conversation. One of the nice things about sort of batting last on these sorts of panel discussions is that you really get the opportunity to build on the important information that everyone who has spoken before you says and is able to share. And I want to start out by kind of going back to underscore one of the really important points that Virginia Arena started out with, which was really the rationale and the important purposes that the SSI Childhood Disability Program plays in the lives of children and youth with significant disabilities in their families. In 1971, as it was in the process of authorizing the SSI program, including the Childhood SSI Disability Program, the House Ways and Means Committee really expressed that core rationale for the program. And I'll read a quote from the committee report. The committee noted that children with disabilities, quote, living in low-income households are among the most disadvantaged of all Americans and are deserving of special assistance in order to help them become self-supporting members of our society. Poor children with disabilities should be eligible for SSI benefits because their needs are often greater than the needs of children without disabilities. Now, on the next slide, I'm going to reiterate some of the points that Virginia Arena made again in highlighting some of the ways that the SSI Childhood Disability Benefit really plays a critical role in the lives of children and youth with disabilities and their families. I think one thing that's really important to think about is the fact that the SSI benefit plays a critical role in helping families to raise children with significant disabilities in the family home. It helps families to support children and helps families to avoid having to think about undesirable alternatives, things like institutionalization of the child. Additionally, as we've already discussed, SSI benefits can be used by families to meet children's needs for food, clothing, and shelter, those basic subsistence needs, and to help families pay for some of the additional costs that can be associated with raising a child with a significant disability. And as you've heard here today, those costs can be quite varied and quite individualized to the need of the child, but they can often add up. And we're talking about families who are very low income, for whom the SSI benefit, while very modest, can also play a very central role in helping to meet some of those often significant costs. Additionally, in many cases, we find that parents who have to take time off work to support a child, to participate in medical appointments or therapy appointments or to meet with school personnel, can use that SSI benefit to help to compensate partially for some of the lost wages that that parent may experience, or in the case where a parent needs to reduce their hours worked or to care for a child with a significant disability full-time, again, the SSI benefit can play an important role. And then finally, and critically important for today's discussion, the SSI benefit is really designed to enhance a child's opportunity to achieve an independent, rewarding, and productive life in adulthood, including through work. Now, on the next slide, as you'll see, we've already noted that about 1.3 million children across the United States receive SSI benefits. Just under a third of them are youth age 14 to 17, so youth in what we typically think of as that transition age period. Youth who receive SSI, or actually children who receive SSI, make up about 1.7% of all children in the U.S., and we also know that about 9% of children in the U.S. are considered to have a serious disability. So children and youth who receive SSI benefits are really a subset of all children with disabilities in the United States. They all must meet that same disability standard under the SSI Childhood Disability Program, but within that they are incredibly diverse. They experience a range of impairments, and in many cases, children experience multiple impairments. Now, we hear at the ARC all the time from parents and youth that the SSI Childhood Benefit is really a lifeline. And on the next slide, I've shared with you one parent's view. This is a mom from Jackson, Mississippi, who a couple of years ago noted, and I'll just quote from what she was able to share. She said that SSI helps my son go to programs that he couldn't attend otherwise. It covers the cost of his medicines, doctors, and counseling. Access to good medical treatment is the biggest benefit. His treatment options before receiving SSI were limited. He also now has one-on-one tutoring, and a counselor comes to school to meet with him there. I've seen a breakthrough in him because of that. SSI has been a tremendous blessing for my son and my family. So on the next slide, when we ask how child SSI receipt affects family economic security, one recent research study found that in a household where a child received SSI childhood disability benefits, that overall household income increased on average by 20%. Additionally, the likelihood of the child living below the federal poverty level decreased by 11%, and the families were able on average to receive fewer benefits from SNAP, WIC, and TANF. In sum, the researchers found that childhood SSI disability benefits substantially lowered poverty rates among affected children. Now, we know that there is a fairly large body of research that highlights that growing up in poverty can have long-term consequences for children's development and for their adult outcomes. So it's probably no surprise that on the next slide, when we look at the long-term impact of childhood SSI receipt, we'll find that the SSI Childhood Disability Program can have positive long-term impacts. One recent study looked at a couple of different cohorts of children awarded SSI benefits in the early 1990s, and they found that on average, childhood SSI receipt was associated with positive outcomes in adulthood, that generally individuals who have received childhood SSI benefits were largely better off years later. I do think this is one area where additional research could be helpful in identifying those positive outcomes and also in looking at some of the gaps that we all would like to see addressed in supporting young adults in promoting those positive outcomes. Now, Commissioner LeBrecq has already noted that when we think about youth transitions for young adults with significant disabilities, that this is a huge topic. And we know that there are many ingredients for successful youth transitions. One research and practice piece under the National Collaborative on Workforce and Disability identified 5 guideposts for success. Those included school preparation, youth development and leadership, career preparation, connecting activities to ensure that youth with disabilities and their families are able to access the resources that they need, as well as family involvement. On the next slide, I'm highlighting that youth and their families really can access these kinds of supports from a variety of sources. And we've already talked about today and highlighted the fact that there are a number of resources from at the federal government and at state and local governments that youth and their families are able to access. Additionally, in many, many cases, nonprofit partners are working closely with federal and state agencies to ensure that these supports and services are available. And within the community, in many cases, youth and their families are able to access resources and natural supports that are available to them in their community and family networks. We know that income support from supplemental security income plays a vital and important role, but it is just one of those ingredients of support. And we've already talked a little bit about the importance of things like health care coverage and long-term services and supports, early intervention and education and employment, basic things like housing and transportation, as well as accommodations and technology and the role of family supports. All of those pieces need to be in place, and it's often a very individualized support system that a young person and their family need to put in place in order to successfully navigate that transition to adulthood. Now, I do want to highlight, as we've already touched on briefly today, that there are a number of work and education incentives available to youth receiving SSI. One of the most important ones is the Student Earned Income Exclusion, which permits students up to age 22 to exclude all income up to about $7,100 per year without affecting their SSI benefits. In addition, young adults receiving SSI can access the general SSI earned income exclusion, which when combined with the general income exclusion under the SSI program will allow a young person to disregard the first $85 of earnings and then half of all earnings thereafter. Additionally, Section 301 encourages youth to finish school and to enroll in employment and training services such as those available under the vocational rehabilitation system. Now, on the next slide, I've highlighted that when it comes to SSI, and I'm going to focus back in here on the SSI program, that we know that youth and their families have many, many questions about the SSI program. In many cases, both anecdotally and in the research, we know that in many cases, young adults and their families have really basic questions about the nature of their benefits, about what that age 18 redetermination process looks like, about what it takes to successfully navigate that process, whether or not they continue to become eligible for SSI benefits. In some cases, we find that youth and their families are not sure about even really basic things like the difference between SSI benefits and SSDI benefits. And one example of that is sometimes we'll hear from young adults that they understand that if they work above a certain level, that they will lose all of their benefits. And that's an example where perhaps the youth were hearing about the SSDI cash cliff, and they may not have as much awareness about some of the work incentives available to them under the SSI program. Additionally, in many cases, young adults and their families have a lot of questions about the relationship between SSI and the adult service system in their state. They may not know whether or not they need to qualify for SSI in order to qualify for adult disability-related and Medicaid-related services, or whether they can access those services even if they are not eligible for SSI benefits as adults. Additionally, in many cases, youth and their families have a lot of questions around what the work incentives are that are available to them under the SSI program, how things like education and participation in vocational rehabilitation and job training programs or work, how those things will affect both their current benefits as well as the benefits that they may be eligible for in the future. Another big issue that comes up for, I think, all young adults transitioning to adulthood, including youth receiving SSI, are questions around money management and how families can support youth receiving SSI as they transition to adulthood to become more engaged and more active in their money management, and hopefully to really take control of that money management and be successful money managers, regardless of their source of income. Additionally, at this age, in many cases, young adults are thinking about where they're going to live as they enter their 20s. They're very interested in living more independently, living in the community, and they want to know how those different living arrangements may impact their SSI benefits. And then finally, you know, in some cases, parents in those teen years may not quite be ready for conversations about love and relationships and marriage, but you better bet that teenagers who are receiving SSI benefits have a lot of questions about those things. And how marriage in the future may impact their SSI benefits is another area where you'll hear a lot of questions from young people and their families. So what helps? Well, if you talk with youth and their families, and if you look at the research, you'll find that there are a lot of things that can make a really big difference. We've already talked about the impact of transition coordination and service coordination. We know that that can play a critical difference in helping young adults and their families to navigate the service system more broadly, as well as the SSI system. Information and education are power. And as I noted earlier, there are often some significant gaps there. There are important opportunities for federal partners as well as nonprofits to really play a role here in promoting outreach and education and ensuring that young adults and their families have as much information as possible about how to successfully navigate the adulthood transition. In many cases at the ARC, we hear from families and individuals that wherever it's possible to have a consistent point of contact within the SSA field office, that that can be really helpful to them. And within adult service systems in general, that having somebody who can really work with them, who can be that consistent base, can be something they really value, knowing who to pick up the phone and talk with. Again, youth and their families really value anything that can be done to ensure that the paperwork and processes are as clear and as simple as possible and as easy to navigate as possible. Again, youth and their families report that knowledgeable staff at the SSA field offices, at partner agencies, and in the community really make a difference. I'm looking at Cheryl Bates Harris right now, and I'm thinking about the WIPAs and the PATs as an example, in addition to the field offices. And then finally, we hear a lot from youth and their families about the importance of having available and accessible services in the field offices as well as online and on the telephone. And I don't think that this is an either-or. What we often hear is that people really value the opportunity to pick up the phone. They value the opportunity to go online and to access information there, to submit information to federal agencies online. But they also really value the opportunity to come into a field office and to sit down with somebody who's knowledgeable, who can assist them in that setting as well. So all of those things make a difference, and ensuring that those services and supports are available and accessible really can make a difference. So in closing, I just want to reiterate the fact that we know that SSI childhood disability benefits are really a lifeline for children and youth and their families. I want to circle back to a point made at the beginning of the presentation, that youth receiving SSI are incredibly diverse, that they have a wide range and varied interests, abilities, support needs, and that the services and supports that are going to assist each individual youth really need to be tailored to that individual. We know that linkages are critical with federal government, with nonprofits, and with community resources, and we know that all of these stakeholders play an important role in promoting positive youth outcomes. So thank you so very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I look forward to the question and answer. Thank you.
Thanks, TJ. We're going to mix things up a little bit. We're going to go to questions from everybody here today and on the phone. But before that, Just so I make sure I make this important point, we referenced the idea that we will have an idea scale, and you'll all be sent links, and there's information in your packets about that, where we ask you to think about five specific questions. It's useful for me to kind of prep you for those questions so you can give us some thoughtful responses. So before we go to the Q&A, let me mention those. You've heard a little bit about the redetermination at age 18. There are individuals who receive child disability benefits, but when they turn age 18, they don't meet the adult standard. So they no longer get benefits, but they're out there in the world. How do we support that population? So what kind of notices or communication should we have to our childhood population about that age 18 redetermination, including what policies or language on our notices we should look at? I'm glad TJ mentioned the earnings disregard, the student earned income disregard. It turns out on SSI, if you're a student, the earnings disregard is pretty high. It's very hard to lose your SSI benefits. I'm not sure how many people, how well that provision is known. You may want to weigh in with comments on how we can better publicize it, but also just from a policy perspective, does it make sense to even have count earnings for students? If it's high enough where it's really not a factor, how much energy should we put in a policy that even counts earnings for students? So we're asking you to weigh on that. And also alluding to what TJ mentioned at the end with the WIPAs and the PABs, who do you think is best positioned to provide services, transition services to youth? Social Security has some structure. We have contact with our work incentive planning and assistance organizations and the protection advocacy organizations. We have a field structure. We have a great communication structure. Who should be providing the services and informing the public about those services? And then the other question on the idea scale is just other topics that you might be interested in for future disability forums. I wanted to give a little content about that. That's for a homework exercise for everybody. When we send you the link and you look in your packets, feel free to come on idea scale and give us your input about how we can better serve children, either through better programs, better information, or better services. So that's a homework assignment. And with that, I think I'd like to open it up to the floor to see if folks would like to ask any questions of our panelists. We have microphones, and we have folks on the phone. And if people are shy, I will start the questions. But let me give folks a chance to. All right.
I'm happy to get us started.
Okay.
I'm Claire Grandison. I'm from Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. And I spent the past year researching the age 18 redetermination process through a fellowship with the Stoney Foundation. So this, I'm very grateful that you all convened this conversation, and I want to thank all of the panelists for their thoughtful contributions today. Just to share a little bit of my perspective, in Pennsylvania, our cutoff rate is actually 71%, so we're facing a very serious situation for our teenage population. The unemployment rate in Philadelphia is 29%, so we are very concerned about this population. And I just want to quickly flag, for anyone who's not aware of it, the Social Security ruling 11-2P, which pertains to young adults and came out in 2011. I still don't see decision makers acknowledging that very frequently, so if anybody has any ideas about how to raise awareness about that, I would love to discuss it further. But my question, and what I would be interested in discussing more with the panelists, is related to Section 301, because throughout all of my research, I see this as a program that has huge potential and is very underused. In Pennsylvania, only about 118-year-olds had continuing benefits under that program in 2012. Still waiting for more up-to-date data about that. But I see it as having such great potential because it can serve exactly that population that just doesn't meet that legal definition of disability but still has such severe needs based on their receipt of SSI benefits as a child. And it has all of the right incentives to participate in vocational rehabilitation programs, to take advantage of extra years in school. I really don't see any downsides. But some of the barriers I see to people participating in that program are that they are not becoming enrolled in vocational rehabilitation programs soon enough. I'm delighted that Commissioner LeBrack is here, and I would be very interested in hearing from anybody both ways that we could get people enrolled in vocational rehabilitation programs sooner, but also on the Social Security side, if there's any way that we could make this program, bring it more in line with the reality of the situation, because right now a 3-month gap is permitted between leaving high school and enrolling in a VR program, but it actually takes 5 months to get an eligibility determination and to develop an employment plan with a VR agency. So the timelines aren't exactly in line. So I think that there could be discussions within both of those agencies, and I'm interested to hear if anybody else has other ideas about how we could open up that program to increase participation.
Thank you for your question. That statistic you just gave just totally blew me away, the 29%, you know, unemployment, but I'm not sure why it blew me away because, you know, it really shouldn't. But I wanted to just speak specifically about the VR program in terms of the early inception into the VR program. And I know that I was recently in Pennsylvania, and I know that the messaging both around WIOA and the pre-employment transition services for vocational rehabilitation is specifically designed to look at those issues to encourage and to, encourage the agencies to begin at a younger age, but also to begin addressing the pre-employment transition needs of youth. And so we are going to have to do a lot of work in that particular area. Many of the state vocational rehabilitation agencies are doing that work, and it can begin at the high school level. I personally think that it should begin in elementary school. It should begin much, much earlier than that, and that the states who have the resources to be able to address some of these issues as early as possible, those are going to be your more proactive and much more likely to, you know, accomplish success for those individuals. Being proactive and being early in that process, looking at early internship work experiences later on for the older transition age, just looking at apprenticeship opportunities, but doing that preliminary work early on. And so some of the legislation out of WIOA will begin to address some of those issues in terms of the type of services that individuals need earlier. So hopefully that will help address some of the concerns that you had.
So I... Taking us back, you may wonder why I'm even sitting here on this panel, but I think there's opportunity in thinking about healthcare system playing a role. So one of the things when we're talking about that transition process and preparing the young person and the family to successfully transition into healthcare, part of that preparation is working with the young person through those early years to help them, and I don't know how many of you recall when you went to your pediatrician or your family physician, they go through some history and they ask you how you're doing, how is school going on, and hopefully they even may have asked you what your plans are, whether to continue advanced schooling or employment. We're thinking that part of that process is for the young person with disability should be asked the same questions and, in fact, should be incorporated into their transition plans. What are their goals? What are they getting the services necessary? So one of the things we want to build into that transition planning is to be able to ask all those questions and to assist the practitioner to build that into the questions they would be asking. While they will not have all the information on where to access the services, we hope to also provide that support with the information, what's available in the community, so that they can know where to go to get that information, and that's part of the care coordination to assist the family in accessing that information. So it's aspirational, but that's something we hope will be built into part of that healthcare system. And in fact, we have initiated some discussion and some work with the Department of Labor on making better connections and sharing information, and hopefully we'll do the same with Social Security Administration.
Sure. Just to, I appreciate that. Just to close out the a couple things for you from Social Security's end, I think you should incorporate your comments in the idea scale so we have a record and can think about it. But you raised two things. Let's better publicize 301. It's a great provision. You get people in these programs. Their benefits continue as long as they're in the program. And two, I think you're raising some issues about the timing, the 3 versus 5 month, which is a regulatory issue. But again, if you raise it with the idea scale, it'll be on the record and we can think about policy changes. So thank you for your question. Anyone else? Any from the phone?
If you're listening over the phone lines and would like to ask a question, please press star 1.
If I could just add, as we're sort of waiting for the next question, on the question of 301, I think you raise a really important issue around ensuring that people are aware of 301 and know how to use it. And just to sort of add on this outreach piece, in many cases, that really is going to require a very kind of person-intense approach to really sit down with youth and their families and walk them through this, help ensure that people understand what 301 means and how to use it. And that may be a process that requires resources. So I think it's important to be clear about that there may be resources that need to be at the table on that outreach piece, in addition to making sure that just that the information is out there, that individualist approach can really make a difference, and it's important.
That's an excellent point. Cheryl, did you want to?
My name is Amber Davis, and I'm a doctoral student at Howard University studying social work and also a NACI fellow and intern at Social Security Advisory Board currently. And my question is around foster care youth who are, you know, dually transitioning, a lot of them, out of foster care and also may also be transitioning to adulthood and receiving SSI. And I wanted to know what are some of the better or best practices around helping them to transition with their situation of being foster care youth.
I can talk about that a little bit. And some of my colleagues who are here today, Joy Cobb and Debbie Engler, and I sort of started to look at that issue. And I know Laura Jack also put out a research paper on that issue. If you look on our website, I think you should be able to find it. I can't remember when I was going to say recently, but I don't know if it was that recently. There was a Palms that came out, I mean, not that recently, within a few years, that kind of allowed youth who would be aging out of foster care to apply for adult benefits earlier, kind of to solve sort of with the same issue with that there's this timing gap between when an application goes in and when you would be eligible to receive benefits. And I'm sorry, I don't remember sort of the exact Palm citation on that, but I can get it to you. I know California, the state of California, has done a lot of work on this issue. There's some funding issues around providing the benefits while also receiving sort of the foster care payments. So they kind of have to work around it. I want to say that's AB 12. I can't quite remember, but I do have that, and I can kind of get back to you on that. And Joy or Debbie, you can jump in and add anything.
Well, I'll mention one thing. So we did change some policy around foster care to allow individuals to apply for benefits prior to exiting foster care. So it's kind of a rich policy area, and even though that wasn't one of our questions on idea scale, if you put some additional policy ideas you have in there, we'll certainly read them. But it is an area we've been a little bit active in. I don't know if any of our other panelists have had experience with foster care youth and sort of the issues around transition.
I know that for the VR program, there many of the counselors are actually the case coordinators for any of the consumers that are on their particular caseload, and I know that they do interface, you know, with the foster care system. And I can tell you that vocationally for those foster care youth, they, if they're receiving SSI but they're also in the vocational rehabilitation program, it should have absolutely no impact on them. And as a matter of fact, if they're in the vocational rehabilitation program, it should actually help them. So I think that one of the issues around coordinating and just ensuring that the information is both there and that there is an interface between the foster care system that is engaging both with the counselor as well as the individual who is in foster care as they navigate and coordinate through their planning process in the VR system, that there should not be an impact, and they certainly should continue to go through the program without there being an impact financially on them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Cheryl?
Yes, this is Cheryl Bates Harris from the National Disability Rights Network. And I'm a little confused and at the same time a little, I'm not sure with some of the data. For instance, Molly indicated that like a very, very small percentage of SSI recipients actually find their way to vocational rehabilitation. And I'm really, I continue to be shocked by the fact that we have kids with very, very significant disabilities that will qualify for disability benefits as a child, and yet they're not receiving special education services. And that percentage alone, the small percentage that are getting special ed students, I think that we have a lot of public programs that are just missing the mark and not fulfilling their mandate, because there is a child find provision within IDEA that says they should be looking for those. And we have really good books on the laws, or we have really good laws on the books that talk about the fact that you get services under IDEA and there's transition requirements that are supposed to occur before a person exits the school system, and there's coordination between IDEA and VR, and yet we see so many people falling into this big black hole and in fact ending up in segregated employment settings and sheltered workshops. And I don't understand why there isn't better coordination, better outreach. I know it's a labor-intensive resource, but if families were notified that transition is going to occur, there's going to be a redetermination, they should be looking towards a transition plan for vocational services that would protect, would assure the continuation of the benefit. It goes back to 301. If the person would not meet the adult standard, that it would still afford them an opportunity for vocational training and, you know, improved quality of life. And I don't understand why that's so difficult. And since I'm on a soapbox, I just have one more thing to say. And that's the fact that, you know, VR has stepped up to the plate a lot more in recent years with transitions and going into the high schools. But they don't explain to the student or to the parents that they're there in a consultative role only, that in order to access the VR services, it requires an affirmative application on their part. And when we've suggested that perhaps VR counselors going into the schools could take VR applications with them, it's been deemed an unreasonable request. So I'm just kind of wondering if somebody can help me figure this out, because someday I would like to retire.
Well, sure. We don't want that to happen. But let me start off, and then others can weigh in here. One of the interesting things that in our programs is that prior to the Ticket to Work legislation, we actually used to do case referrals to VR. And then those were stopped with the legislation with the idea of they wanted to make sure that the employment networks had a level playing field. But one of the things that still is in the law and is interesting is that SSA is required by law to refer SSI children who are under 16 to Marie's programs. So we are supposed to, for SSI children under 16, actually refer that case to the state agencies that is administering the maternal and child health grants. And that's one possible way that we can kind of bring in other partners like VR and so forth. And maybe that's something we need to think a little bit more about. But I do take your point that how do we get our folks plugged into the broader system of VR services and healthcare services? And I don't know if other panelists would like to add a little bit.
Sure, I'll add to that because there are a couple of areas that you mentioned, particularly around children. First of all, the VR system is not a system that has responsibility for a child until they are getting out of high school. Until they're VR can come in and open up a case at age 14, and they can begin the ancillary services or the peripheral services actually for an individual, but the school system is actually responsible for those individuals. However, having said that, many of the VR agencies around the country absolutely have a referral system in place for individuals who are, in fact, in school system and receiving services under special education. It absolutely needs to improve. I'm one of those products of both a private school for the blind as well as being in public school system, and I never saw a VR counselor, so I know that you're saying what you're saying, unfortunately, has not, you know, dissipated over time. However, having said that also, it's an entirely different conversation when you mentioned the issue about sheltered workshops. The VR system does not have any auspices over sheltered workshops. The VR system, as a matter of fact, does not even permit individuals to successfully receive a competitive goal outcome closure if an individual is in a sheltered workshop. The purview and oversight of that program, that particular program, that part of it is with the Department of Labor. However, individuals certainly come out of school systems, and you, if you're familiar at all with the Rhode Island settlement case, we are hopeful that that will be one of the decisions that will certainly help with the issue of when these individuals are in the school system, they can actually negated the VR system just by recommending that individuals go into workshops. Part of that is also a result of parents also being very concerned that their children they don't want their children to go to work, or they may not foresee their children as being able to seek out competitive integrated employment, and there is a real marketing issue with that. I was just doing another presentation yesterday, and this came up as well, and the other issue is the fact that they want to make sure that their individual loved ones can still continue to receive their benefits, so they don't want them to earn a wage that will disconnect them from, you know, the SSI system. And again, that's a marketing issue as well. Absolutely, we need to improve, you know, that connection. In Massachusetts, we designed, and I'm the former commissioner for that agency as well, for the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. And in Massachusetts, we designed a system so that the agencies that were considered the lead agency, and then the school systems who had these individuals with disabilities within their school network at the age of 16 were required to provide our agency with a referral so that we could, in fact, begin to identify those individuals and begin to prepare to put those services in place. That way they were not falling into that so-called black hole that you referred to as well in your remarks, so that perhaps a strategy for looking at ways that states can, in fact, partner and network with, you know, their LEAs and their special ed departments within their respective states to come up with a process, a referral process to connect rather than ensuring that individuals go disconnected between the two systems.
I just wanted to underscore one of the points that I think Cheryl was getting at around this question, which is the fact that we know that having paid work in the community as a young adult is one of the most powerful predictors of later employment success in adulthood. That's why Section 301 is so critically important. That's why the student earned income exclusion under the SSI benefit is critically important, and why so many of the supports and services that we've been talking about related to employment and exploring those community paid work experiences are absolutely essential. David had asked earlier around the student earned income exclusion if there might be ways to strengthen that, and you know, one that we've looked at for many years within the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and at the ARC is indeed allowing students to disregard all income earned during those student years to remove any potential fears that students and their families may have. So I just wanted to kind of circle back and emphasize how important that community work experience is, and anything we can do at both a policy and a practice perspective to promote that. So thank you.
Thanks, TJ. I think we have one question on the phone.
No, we have no questions over the phone lines at this time.
Okay. Does anybody in the audience here today want to ask one more question before we wrap up?
Well, David, just I wanted to go back here to the comments about foster care and receipt of Social Security benefits and SSI. The state of play, as I recall it, was that when SSA issued an amicus brief on the state of Washington lawsuit a number, decade, 11 years ago, something like that, basically it gave SSA's blessings on the states to essentially confiscate, I will use that word deliberately, whatever a child is receiving from Social Security by way of a benefit to reimburse the state for the cost of providing foster care. Even though there may be compelling other interests, Stacy reminded me of a case that she was aware of where there was an inheritance, a child got a house and wanted to use some of the money that they were getting to pay the taxes on it while they were aging out of foster care, but that was not allowed. Did you say that there were some changes in that policy? Has it softened? Have you revisited it? Are you planning to revisit it? Because you're thinking about transition from receiving benefits to, out in the cold, cold world, being able to have a little bit of that money that expires when you turn age 18 might be helpful.
No, I appreciate the policy idea. I think I was talking about something a little bit different, which is that we would allow individuals to apply for benefits they might be due at age 18 earlier in the process than we were allowing before. So that was more of a minor. Your point about the general policy on foster care is worth raising and something, one of those policy ideas we should think about in terms of youth transition. I appreciate everybody hanging in for the full meeting. Let me turn it over to Gioni if you want to offer some closing remarks for us.
Thank you, David. Hi, my name is Jay Gioni Palmer. I'm the Associate Commissioner for External Affairs. I just want to first thank you all for coming out, taking the time out of your schedule to join us in this conversation. This is very, I certainly learned a lot, and I hope you all did. We use this forum here to get ideas about policy as well as messaging. So your feedback and participation with the evaluation are incredibly important. And again, not just we welcome all feedback, not just on the content, but also in terms of our surveying methods as well. So please give us some insights on that. Before we close, I want to remind everybody that we are officially 29 days away from celebrating the 80th anniversary of Social Security on August 14th, and there are a number of resources and materials on our website, socialsecurity.gov, that are marking that occasion. One event that will be taking place next week on Thursday, July 23rd, from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., we're having a Hill event where it's going to be taking place in the Dirksen Senate Office Building registered, thank you, and we look forward to seeing you. If you have not registered and wish to do so or have not even received an invite, will Social OEA personnel raise your hands? All right. So you need to see Joey back at the table or Marianne here, and we will make sure that Arnaldo over there, and make sure that you get the invitation if you so choose. So once again, please remember to continue this policy dialogue as we ask you to participate on our idea scale, the link that will be sent to you after our meeting today. It will be open for a couple of weeks, so talk with us. We want to hear from you. We look forward to continuing to work together so that we can continue to improve the services for the folks that we all serve. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.